From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Today we celebrate the Halloween season by talking with the director of the movie Halloween, John Carpenter. He also made The Thing, Christine, Escape from New York, and the new science fiction thriller They Live. We also speak with actor Peter Scolari on the TV series Newhart. Scolari plays a character that some people consider as scary as anything John Carpenter's come up with, the self-absorbed yuppie Michael Harris. And we have reviews of the new Mission Impossible and a new reissue featuring jazz singer Dinah Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Ten years ago, in the Halloween season, moviegoers watched a teenaged babysitter, played by newcomer Jamie Lee Curtis, protect herself against a psychotic murderer. He had escaped from a mental institution and returned to his hometown to murder teenage girls, girls who reminded him of the older sister he stabbed to death when he was a child. Halloween was a low-budget thriller that was a huge box office success. It established the career of my guest, John Carpenter, who directed, co-wrote, and scored the film. Carpenter makes the kind of movies he's always loved, horror, science fiction, and action films. His movies include Assault on Precinct 13, The Fog, Escape from New York, the remake of The Thing, Christine, Starman, and Big Trouble in Little China. Carpenter's new movie, They Live, opens this Friday. In this one, Earth has become a third-world planet exploited by aliens. The aliens disguise themselves as humans and use mass media to hypnotize Earthlings into submission. Some humans gladly sell out their planet and assist the aliens in return for money and other material gains. Here's a scene from They Live.
No, you gotta listen to me. I thought you boys understood. It's business. That's all it is. You still don't get it, do you, boys? There ain't no countries anymore. No more good guys. They're running the whole show. What's wrong with having it good for a change? Now, they're gonna let us have it good if we just help them. They're gonna leave us alone. Let us make some money. You can have a little taste of that good life, too. Now, I know you want it. Hell, everybody does.
You do it to your own kind.
What's the threat? We all sell out every day. Might as well be on the winning team. See you, boys.
John Carpenter, welcome to Fresh Air. Do you see your new movie as a parable about things that are actually happening?
I see my new film as basically a political satire masquerading as a science fiction thriller. It's much in the same vein that Gulliver's Travels, say, for instance. Jonathan Swift wrote about little people and big people, but he was really talking about folks that were in the government of his time. And They Live is about aliens who control the Reagan revolution. They are dismantling the middle class, making the poorer, the rich richer, and they are basically free enterprisers from another galaxy. And what they want to do is exploit the Earth as a third world. So I would say basically the creatures and the threat in They Live boils down to maybe Republicans.
Well, you know, the human that's supposed to be saving us from this alien threat is played by Rowdy Roddy Piper, who fans of a World Wrestling Federation know has been until he retired one of the big wrestlers, and also had his own little like talk show, in which all the vendettas in the wrestling world were played out. And I'll tell you, it's hard to see him as the guy who's going to help uphold human values.
Well, why is it so difficult? I mean, he upholds human values in the ring. He might as well do it in the movies. Actually, Roddy, I saw his last match at WrestleMania 3. I've been a wrestling fan for many years, and I met him there. And what I wanted to do in this picture was to tell the story from the point of view of the homeless, from a man of the street, from the underclass of society, basically a blue-collar working man who moves from town to town. He's kind of an existential hero. Name of John Nada, Nada being the Spanish word for nothing. And Roddy seemed to me to be a guy who looked as if he came from the streets. He lived life. He wasn't a movie star who drives down Rodeo Drive. Basically, He's been a wrestler for 17 years, I believe, and has a lot of natural innate talent. And we worked very hard on his role, and I think he did a great job.
They Live is a fairly low-budget film. You've made movies with bigger budgets. Usually it works the other way around. A movie director starts off with low budgets and it gets more and more money as time goes along. Have you given up on large budget studio-financed pictures?
Not particularly. I will do a bigger budgeted picture in the future. But I signed a four-picture deal to make four films on a lower budget to be released through Universal domestically in order to retain a final cut on my movies. I think one of the problems with making big-budget films is that once the budget goes to a certain figure, you have to make about three times that money back in box office receipts in order to make a profit. And the profit incentive in films often tends to force the director or creator into lots of compromises. People tend to get very nervous and they want the lowest common denominator again. And I got a little tired of feeling myself pressured in that way. So by being able to make films without the financial pressure, without the profit motive being what fuels the project, I was able to do more unusual films.
Well, you've said that you want to be a good commercial filmmaker and that you've wanted to be the Howard Hawks of the 80s. Let me ask you to explain what you mean.
Well, I probably, when I said that, mean that Howard Hawks was a big influence in my career. I liked the way he made movies, his visual style, his approach to films, his approach to actors, and his point of view in the world. I think that if I had my choice, I'd be doing the kinds of pictures that Hawks did. I wish I could make some Westerns, because they're really my favorite form. Actually, truthfully, that They Live is a Western, but don't tell anybody.
Okay. John Carpenter is my guest, and he directed the films Halloween, The Thing, Christine, Escape from New York, and a new movie called They Live, and most of those films he co-wrote as well. Let's talk about your first big commercial success, Halloween, which was an independently made film, I believe the most successful most commercially successful independently made film ever made. You shot it in around 20 days for $300,000. You co-wrote, directed, and scored this movie. Did it being a low-budget film help justify you doing all of that? Do you know what I mean?
Well, in a sense, it was my opportunity to do all that. I came from USC film school, in which usually we didn't have any money to do the extra frills that you have in Hollywood. So I was able to do the scores, and I was able to actually shoot some of the films and edit them and so forth. And I brought that kind of approach to filmmaking into commercial filmmaking in Hollywood. And Halloween was the first time that I was able to utilize it with a little bit more money than I'd been used to before. I did my first film for $60,000, and this was a $300,000 film. That was a lot more. And it established me as somebody who could do the scores to films and direct and write and so forth, and I just got lucky.
Halloween was, in a way, one of the first in a long string of teenager In Jeopardy movies, where young teenage girls were being threatened and murdered by some demonic either monster or insane person preying on them in the suburban neighborhood. How did you come up with this story, and did you intentionally go for a teenager in jeopardy idea?
Well, in a sense, it was given to me by the producer of the film. He said, let's do a movie about these babysitters who get attacked by this creature. And based on that kind of idea, I came up with Halloween. I think the imitators of Halloween saw a chance to do two things: make lots of money for a low budget, and also perhaps have an entree to get into Hollywood and direct some legitimate pictures. I think people saw it as a vehicle to other avenues. My love of horror and science fiction allowed me to continue in the genre and move out of it occasionally. I did a love story once called Starman. And I did a kung fu picture called Big Trouble in Little China. But essentially, I've been associated with the fantasy genre. And Halloween really was the first one.
In Halloween, there are three teenage girls who are the main characters. One of them is played by Jamie Lee Curtis. Two of the girls are much more socially oriented than the Jamie Lee Curtis character is, and they're already having sex with their boyfriends, where Jamie Lee Curtis is clearly the virgin. Your film was the first in a line of movies where a lot of people thought that the girls who were having sex were being punished by being murdered later on in the movie. Was that a conscious thing on your part? It certainly became a theme as these movies went on.
I think probably what happened was this country started taking an enormous right turn at that point. And I think that people projected that onto the film. Basically, my intention was to show teenagers as realistically as possible. I have nothing against the behavior of the two girls. I will say that from a screenwriter's point of view, the Jamie Lee Curtis character, who was a much more repressed, uncomfortable with her emotions and uncomfortable with being social with her peers, she had a more of a connection with this mad killer and was able to survive him, where the other girls weren't paying attention. They were involved in their own lives and their interests. So that, from a screenwriter's point of view, was my idea to do what I did.
I think in a lot of ways, Halloween was an exercise in building suspense. And let me just play a short clip from the movie. This is a clip of Jamie Lee Curtis. And by the way, this is her first really big film role. And in the credits, it says, "Introducing Jamie Lee Curtis." The way the story builds is, first she thinks maybe that somebody's following her, and by the end she knows it's true and that she's being attacked. So here she is, running from house to house, screaming for help. Some of the things that you learned in making Halloween about how to make the audience nervous, how to get them worried about the character's well-being, how to build suspense?
Well, you first have to start with the story. You have to have a story that involves a certain amount of suspense in terms of the characters, the antagonist and the protagonist being on a collision course. Their destinies are going to cross. You know eventually that whatever represents evil in your film is going to have to rear its ugly head and come after you. And your job in a thriller like this is to get the audience to identify with the victim. And Jamie being our focus of identity, we can begin to feel her panic and running away from this kind of ultimate evil that's after her. And I think once you have that kind of a setup, well, you can then begin to build suspense in the audience. Now, suspense really simply means anxiety. The audience is anxious about what's going to be seen, what's going to be coming up. Whenever Jamie would walk into a dark room, perhaps, they'd say, "But don't go in there. Can't you go someplace else?" They're putting themselves into the character. They're trying to tell her to watch out. I think that's the primary idea in Halloween in terms of building suspense.
And the audience knows just a little bit more than the characters do about what's happening. So they know about the danger she's about to get into.
Well, in general, they know that he's out there, because they've known that since the beginning of the film. What they don't know is exactly where he is. So the audience is also waiting in suspense for, when is he going to jump out of the dark? I know it's going to come, because this is a horror film, and they always do this kind of thing, don't they? So now we're walking in a dark room. It's kind of dark in here. Now, where will he be? And the longer that you can wait and let the audience imagine where he might be, and then all of a sudden have him spring out, the more in suspense they will be.
You know, Ebert and Siskel, the film reviewers, have something that they call the idiot plot, that a lot of horror movies hinge on the main character doing something absurdly stupid. Like, for instance, the character's running, and they just slowly walk away with their back turned, where if they could have ran away really quickly if they were thinking. Do you think that there's a lot of idiot-type plots in suspense films, and is it easy to get around that?
Well, I think that what they're talking about is something that's done intentionally. For instance, in the Friday the 13th movies, the idiot plot was basically invented in order to get the audience to participate. Because if you have a teenager walking into a room and they turn their back on their on the danger and wander through kind of innocently, the audience feels superior to the character and they can start screaming, "You idiot, why don't you get out of there?" And in being superior to the characters, as soon as the incredibly evil and powerful boogeyman steps out, then they can laugh in derision and say, "Oh, I told you so. If you'd only listened to me, you would have it would have saved your life." Basically, this is a technique to get the audience to throw their identity much more towards the killer, which I have a little bit of a problem with. I don't subscribe to that quite so much. I think that we should be making films about the victims and exploring that kind of human emotion. I don't identify with the killers in these films.
Have you seen the movies that came after Halloween that were in part inspired by it? Prom Night, Fright Night, the Friday the 13th movies?
I really didn't have the heart to see them. I've seen occasionally glance at them on television, but they... what bothers me about a lot of horror films is that I don't think they're made by people who have a feeling for the story they're telling. I would say to the audience that there are certain directors who are extremely committed to the genre they're working in, David Cronenberg and George Romero, as two examples. Those filmmakers who feel and have a personal point of view to express in this particular genre. A lot of the movies that copy other films are simply trying to utilize the technique without the heart. And in that sense, I wouldn't recommend them.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is film director John Carpenter. His movies include Halloween, the remake of The Thing, Christine, Escape from New York, and a new movie called They Live, which is scheduled to open this Friday. And he also co-wrote the scripts and composed most of the music for his movies. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
John Carpenter is my guest. And before we completely get off the subject of Halloween, I have to ask you, at the end of Halloween 1, the psychopath dies, we think. But then the body disappears and we figure he might be alive enough for a sequel. And sure enough, Halloween 4 just opened. Did you intentionally leave this open for a sequel, thinking, well, maybe there's a possibility for another movie here?
Well, when I made Halloween, what I was attempting to do was build a myth, an American myth of evil, because I feel that we are a culture without myths and mysteries. We tend to be technological much more, and we tend to be very sterile in our feelings. And I wanted to create the idea of the ultimate evil, the boogeyman, the legendary mythical creature out there. And of course, he couldn't be killed. And in my mind was not so much a sequel as a kind of an old Henry ending. But I noticed that the audiences over time have become extremely cynical. They assume that if you end a movie uncertainly or with some sort of ambiguity, that the filmmaker is up to a sequel, and that's really a shame. I think this is due in part to television. We have become kind of hypnotized to a certain kind of dramatic form by television. It all has to wrap up for us in the last few minutes, and that's too bad.
Have you been affiliated with any of these sequels? Did you work on any of them?
I produced Halloween 2 and 3, and then I decided that's enough. Really, sequels, what the studios want you to do in a sequel is to remake the same film again with the same elements, the same characters and just basically take the script and redo it. And that's difficult to do. Once you've done something, you have to ask yourself, why am I doing this? And we did in Halloween 3, we did a completely different kind of film. Had nothing to do with the shape, had nothing to do with the original characters. And the audience, strangely enough, just wouldn't accept it. They all said, well, where is that killer with a knife? We want to see the same picture again. So at that point, I said, no, I'm not going to do this anymore.
You made, I think, the ultimate New York horror film, Escape from New York, which is this urban fantasy set in the late 1900s in Manhattan, where Manhattan has become a maximum security prison. So the only people there are prisoners, and there's dozens of little prisoner societies there all trying to kill off each other. And Kurt Russell is sent into Manhattan to try to rescue the president, who's been kidnapped by one of these prisoner groups. And it's a very funny movie in a way, in part because, let me play a scene which I think explains why. Ernest Borgnine plays a cabbie in this. He's been driving a cab for years, and you know he's one of the prisoners on Manhattan Island who's still driving a cab. And although the crime has gotten to the point where there's decapitated heads sitting on top of parking meters, he's talking to Kurt Russell as if it's just the horrors we're regularly familiar with in Manhattan that he's got to face.
Bad neighborhood, Snake. You don't want to be walking from the Bowery to 42nd Street at night. I've been driving a cab here for 30 years, and I'm telling you, you don't walk around here at night. Yes, sir. It'll kill you, strip you in 10 seconds flat. Usually, I'm not down around here myself. But I wanted to catch that show. This stuff is like gold around here, you know. Hey, what were you doing back there, Snake?
Looking for somebody.
Well, why didn't you ask me? Hell, I know everybody in this town. Yes, sir, I've been driving this cab for 30 years, this very same cab.
I'm gonna ask you. Now, where's the president?
The Duke got him. Everybody knows the Duke's got him. Well, you don't have to put a gun to my head, I'll tell you.
Who's the Duke?
The Duke? The Duke of New York, eh, number one? The big man, that's who.
Now I want to meet this Duke.
You can't meet the Duke. Are you crazy? Nobody gets to meet the Duke. You meet him once and then you're dead.
Although you did create this ultimate New York, ultimate Manhattan paranoid fantasy. You grew up in Kentucky. You grew up in a pretty rural area yourself.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Were there movie theaters in walking distance where you grew up?
Not walking distance. I could ride my bicycle down to the theater. I grew up in probably the last time in America where you could really have a small town and really have the kind of innocence and freedom. We didn't lock our doors and so forth. There was no real crime. And I think that my fascination with New York and Los Angeles and big cities, as someone who grew up in the South in a kind of a rural areas, carried me through my filmmaking career. I recall once when I was coming into New York to do some press on a film, and I had read a newspaper account of some plutonium in the water supply in New York. So I asked the driver. I said, "Well, how do you feel about that?" And he kind of grinned with pride. He says, "Ah, you know, who cares." I thought that's a really odd attitude. And I noticed that a lot of New Yorkers kind of have a pride about how terrible things are. If there's plutonium or there's a lot of crime on the streets, they kind of, yeah, well, you know, what of it?
We can take it.
We can take it, and we're tough. And I found that to be kind of an unusual attitude, so I kind of incorporated it into Escape from New York.
When you were young and you really liked horror movies a lot and monster movies, did you ever weep seeing a movie, ever cry because you were so scared, or ever ask to leave or, you know, run out in fear?
Well, the first fantasy film I ever saw, my mom took me to see it, came from outer space, and that was in 1953. And it was in 3D. And you put on the glasses, and I had no idea what to expect. And the opening sequence is this meteor streaking across the sky in the desert, and it comes right into the camera and blows up. Well, it came right out of the screen and blew up in my face when I was a kid, and I jumped up and ran up the aisle. And literally, in terror, I didn't know what had just happened. But by the time I got to the back of the theater, I thought, boy, that's probably the greatest thing I've ever seen. I've got to go back and see some more of that. So it was a mixture of of panic and excitement. And sure, there have been lots of films that the popcorn has gone flying in. And I've never cried in terror. I've cried at sentimental movies. But I think probably the scariest movie I ever saw was The Original Thing. That made me jump a lot.
Oh, my favorite line from that is, the monster's a vegetable. What do you do with a vegetable? Fry it, boil it, cook it. Isn't there a line like that?
There is, and there's also one, an intellectual carrot, the mind boggles.
Your hobbies, I've read, are archery and shooting. And I wonder how they became your hobbies.
Well, I grew up around guns. My parents were hunters and North woodsmen, and I kind of grew up around it, and I took archery in college. And my recent hobby since 1982 is I become a helicopter pilot. And because of my experiences on The Thing, I began to be fascinated with helicopters. Mm. And therefore got my license and bought one, and now I fly the skies of Los Angeles.
Have you ever had to use your bow and arrow or your pistol in self-defense?
Not yet.
Have you ever been victimized?
Well, my parents were robbed once. I remember walking into the house and everything was gone. And it's kind of a strange feeling. When I came out to Los Angeles, I brought a Volkswagen along, and it was stolen, I think, 4 times. And I kept getting it back, and then 6 months later it'd be stolen again. Pretty much it became a kind of a routine, so I expected it to come back eventually. But I've never been physically threatened, but of course, in Los Angeles, when you work in Hollywood, you know, it's all palm trees and swimming pools, so you never have to worry about that.
So is your interest in tough guy stuff purely a movie interest?
Well, not necessarily. I grew up with in the South with a bunch of tough guys and a bunch of hillbillies from the backwoods, and they'd be glad to teach you a lesson if you cared to learn it. And I think perhaps the my closest friend as a kid was a guy like this, and I patterned my heroes after him.
If you didn't have to worry about commercial concerns, what kind of movie would you most like to do?
I'd probably be doing exactly what I'm doing now. I enjoy making films that have some elements of fantasy in them, whether it's science fiction or horror or whatever. Love to be able to do a musical or do a Western or something like that. But I love the form of Hollywood films, the dramatic form, the three acts, and the basic premise of a Hollywood movie, which is to take you into a dream for an hour and a half and then send you out in the street again. And I suppose that's what I'd be doing.
How do you like to spend Halloween night?
Well, I have a 4.5-year-old son now, and he's very fascinated with monster movies and science fiction, and he's been watching the same since he was about 2, and he loves monsters. So we get dressed up and go trick-or-treating.
Well, great. Thank you very much for talking with us.
And thank you.
My guest has been John Carpenter, and he directed Halloween, The Thing, Christine, Escape from New York, and a new movie called They Live, which opens this Friday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Dina Abdelhamid. She was once the wife of Jordan's King Hussein and is now married to a lieutenant colonel in the PLO. Her new memoir, Duet for Freedom, is about her husband's imprisonment during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and her successful attempt to negotiate his release. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Actor Peter Scolari has perfected the quintessential yuppie in the character of Michael, the vain, manipulative TV producer on The Newhart Show. We meet Peter Scolari on this edition of Fresh Air. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of recordings from the early 50s by the late jazz singer Dinah Washington. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the ABC remake of Mission Impossible. Returning are Peter Graves and the mysterious voice that gives the assignments, but otherwise the cast is new. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. George Bush today ridiculed Michael Dukakis for calling himself a liberal. Dukakis embraced the label yesterday after distancing himself from that wing of the party for most of the campaign. The Dukakis campaign is heading for the Midwest tonight. Today, the Democratic candidate spoke at two college campus rallies in California. NPR's Ina Jaffe has details.
Michael Dukakis again today identified himself with the liberal tradition of Presidents Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, and John F. Kennedy. Quoting Kennedy, he urged his young listeners not to be satisfied with the status quo, and he said he hoped to inspire in them the same idealism that JFK inspired in his generation 28 years ago. Then he had a special message for the holiday.
It's Halloween tonight, isn't it? Mr. Bush is going to try to pass himself off as an environmentalist.
Dukakis blasted the vice president's record on the environment. He also called George Bush and Dan Quayle dead wrong on every single issue of importance to women: equal pay, child care, parental leave, and abortion. In Los Angeles, I'm Ina Jaffe reporting.
Shiite Muslim hostage takers in Beirut today released a videotape of U.S. captive Terry Anderson in which he accuses the U.S. government of preventing his release. In Los Angeles this afternoon, President Reagan strongly denied that statement, saying he believes Anderson was speaking from a script prepared by his kidnappers. The president also disputed Anderson's assertion that Vice President George Bush negotiated with terrorists in the Iran-Contra affair and in a Middle East TWA hijacking. At the State Department, spokesman Charles Redman offered this brief comment on the release of the Anderson tape.
I would just again seize the occasion to say to those who hold hostages that these are innocent victims. They ought to be released now.
Terry Anderson has been held 3.5 years, longer than any of the other foreigners missing in Lebanon. In Jerusalem today, a school teacher and her three children were buried at the Mount of Olives. Their deaths yesterday in the firebombing of a bus, apparently by Palestinians, have fueled predictions that the tragedy will help the hardline Likud party in tomorrow's national elections. In an effort to prevent violence, Israeli soldiers today sealed off the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip for 48 hours. In retaliation for the fatal bus attack, military authorities are maintaining a curfew on the West Bank town of Jericho, where the firebombing took place. Imelda Marcos, the former First Lady of the Philippines, today pleaded not guilty to racketeering and fraud charges in New York. The judge set her bail at $5 million. NPR's Mike Schuster has details.
Imelda Marcos came to federal court this morning in a turquoise traditional Filipino gown. She only spoke when Federal District Judge John Keenan asked her how did she plead. Not guilty, she said, in a clear voice. Judge Keenan set bail at $5 million. Imelda Marcos, her husband Ferdinand, and eight others are accused of racketeering and fraud in connection with the ownership of several office buildings in Manhattan. Mrs. Marcos did not immediately make bail. Her attorneys argued that all the Marcos' property worldwide is tied up in court cases and investigations. The attorneys claimed the Marcoses have been living on borrowed funds since they arrived in Hawaii in February 1986. Mrs. Marcos must remain in New York until she satisfies her bail requirements. I'm Mike Schuster in New York.
The State Department announced today the relaxation of some trade, travel, and diplomatic restrictions against North Korea. State Department spokesman Charles Redman said the steps were being taken in support of the efforts by South Korean President No Tae-woo to promote the reunification of North and South Korea. Stock prices remained largely unchanged today in mixed trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell just over a point to close at 2148.65. Advances and declines were about even on volume of 143 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 3 cents. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of some reissued Dinah Washington recordings from the 1950s. Washington died at the age of 39 in 1963. Kevin says her career was often a triumph of style over uneven material.
You told me you would leave me here in tears. Now you're gone and hours seem like years. So darling, I sing my song.
Some folks say Dinah Washington wasn't really a jazz singer. They're wrong, but they have their reasons. Washington's hit-hungry producers had her sing jazz, blues, rhythm and blues, calypso, country western, Christmas songs, and novelty numbers. She used to boast she could sing anything, a boast put to the test by an ongoing series of reissues, The Complete Dinah Washington on Mercury. The series will eventually run to 7 volumes of 3 CDs each, tracing her career from 1946 to 1961. The 3rd and 4th installments are now out. Volume 3, which begins in 1952 and ends in 54, is to me the best of the lot so far. For one thing, it catches the singer in at least one uncompromising jazz setting, a studio jam session with drummer Max Roach and trumpeter Clifford Brown. Richie Powell plays piano.
Your lips were warm and love and spring were new. But I'm not afraid of autumn and her sorrow. I'll remember April and I'll remember you.
Dinah Washington admired Billie Holiday, but where Holiday would gently mock a dumb lyric, Washington sang any remotely serious song as if she meant it. On a surreptitiously recorded Crazy She Calls Me from that same studio jam session, Washington mimics Billie Holiday as she sounded toward the end of her life. But even here, Washington's torn between playing the fool and getting serious with the tune. Herb Geller plays alto sax.
I say I'll care forever, and I mean forever. If I have to hold up the sky, crazy, he calls me. Sure, I'm crazy. Crazy in love, am I?
To confess, I like Dinah Washington as much for the bad songs she sang as for the good ones. One 1953 novelty subverted the radio medium on which it was played.
If you wanna have fun, come home with me. You can stay all night and play with my TV. TV is the thing this year, TV is the thing. Oh yes, radio was great, but now it's out of date. TV is the thing this year. Last night I was watching old time mix. My TV broke, boy, I was in a fix. I got on the phone, called my man, said, get here, daddy, as fast as you can.
TV is the thing this year.
Oh yes, TV is the thing this year. Radio was great, but now it's out of date. TV is the thing this year.
TV is the thing this year has some inspired details, like that soap opera organ work. The trendy bongos reinforce TV's alleged faddishness, but their relentless beat concedes the tube is here to stay. Not all of Washington's pop vehicles were so thoughtful. Here's a calypso that plays poverty and homelessness for laughs.
I never knew how much food cost then, till that icebox stood defrosted. I just like a babe that's lost then, since me man done gone and went. I'm feeling quite disgusted, those fellas can't be trusted. Me rusted heart is busted, since me man done gone and went. Since me man has gone and went. In the park I pitch me tent, me last half dollar will soon be spent, since me man has gone and went.
Some critics say songs that crass should stay buried. But hearing Washington's best work in the context of her worst makes her artistry more impressive. She never let lousy material get the best of her. By the way, if you like Dinah Washington but don't have the dough to spend on pricey box sets, try the more sensible two-record album called A Slick Chick on the Mellow Side. It's a good survey of Washington's early years at Mercury, and you won't have to hawk the TV.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the third volume of The Complete Dinah Washington on Mercury.
That's one thing I'm learning. I cried, lied, then I almost died for you. What a fool I used to be. I've found two eyes, just a little bit bluer. Baby, I've found a heart, just a little bit truer.
This is Fresh Air. In the TV sitcom Newhart, Bob Newhart plays Dick Loudon, the low-key, kind of square owner of a Vermont inn who also hosts a local TV interview show called Vermont Today. Michael Harris, the producer of Vermont Today, is everything the Newhart character isn't and doesn't want to be. Michael is high-powered, vain, self-absorbed, and obsessed with clothes and success. The character of Michael is played by Peter Scolari, who in his first TV series, Bosom Buddies, starred opposite Tom Hanks. On Newhart, Michael is always pitching ways to jazz up the station with provocative programs. On the season premiere of Newhart, Michael proposed a program in which the wives of criminals would be interviewed.
Picture this, a show devoted to the woman behind the accessory, the mall behind the menace. What do you think?
I think you're demented.
That is just the tip of the iceberg. We interview JoJo on Vermont Today. Are you loving it? You ask the probing questions. What is it about your criminal leanings that attracts her?
Michael, that is not entertainment. That is exploitation.
Tomato, tomato, Dick.
Do you think of yourself as using a different voice and character than the voice that you normally speak with?
Yes, but you know, it's funny, you've raised an interesting point here because I come home the night before, for example, last night from what is effectively the last day of rehearsal, and I can't get the voice out of my own speaking voice. I think my own speaking voice is more along the lines of what we're hearing today. And Michael's voice is more in here. It's just a little shift that I make. I try not to think about it much. It's just something I've kind of lapsed into on occasion. But I'll come home from, hopefully I've changed back to my voice now. But I'll come home from a Thursday rehearsal and my wife will say, "How did it go today, honey?" And I'll say, "It went great. I've got to tell you, I'm secure with my..." And I'll realize somewhere along the line that I haven't let it go. And I can't. It's very frightening.
You know, your character is always described as the ultimate yuppie. But I think, to me, it's as if you also went back to, like, old screwball comedies and watched, like, the really wealthy people, the old money people, and got some of their mannerisms.
Yes, although, you know, Michael in point of fact, at least as I perceive him, is not really a very successful yuppie at all. Michael doesn't drive a BMW or a Mercedes. He probably didn't finish college, as we understand it. And I think he attempts to affect or at least to join in with the trend of, you know, upwardly mobile, preppy type people. But he's not really successful at it. So that's part of my my link to any success at all with a character, I think, is that he's a failed yuppie.
Julia Duffy plays Stephanie, your girlfriend, on The New Heart Show. And it's the perfect match. You just seem so perfectly matched together, the two characters. Two incredibly self-absorbed people in love.
Well, here we are, Steph, at home. Or should I say, in home.
Michael, thank you for the lovely time. Now, is the date officially over?
Yes. What did you think?
Well, I think this makes four dates in a row that haven't been fun.
I know, Steph. I don't know what's wrong. We paraded around town. We played What Would You Buy with $3 million if you had to spend it all on yourself? Had all the ingredients of a great date.
But I didn't even go, ooh, once. Michael, I'm worried we're getting stale. But there's one way to find out for sure. A cosmopolitan test.
How were you matched together? How were you cast together?
Well, it was kind of a nice accident that occurred. I was a guest star in the, let's see now, second season of New Heart on a couple of occasions. But later in that same season, when I was brought back, it was with the expressed intent that Michael and Stephanie meet and hook up and begin their roller coaster ride. And I think we had lines to the effect of, I said to her, I know we've just met, but would you let me take you out for a Manhattan sometime? And she said, I'd let you take me to Manhattan sometime. But I want to tell you. So the romance, or what have you, was born. And Julia and I found right away, I mean, it's obvious that there are perhaps these standard two peas in a pod, these preppies, but we like to think of them as being a lot more and a lot less than that.
You know, I've been really wanting to interview you and find out more about you, but I had this like terrible feeling that you'd think it was your duty to prove that you were smart and sensitive, unlike your character.
No, I've worked through that in therapy, and I now have no longer have the need to prove that on public radio.
No, but it really, I bet that you are expected to prove that in a way, you know, that you're not the character who you play.
Yes, that's true. That is true. I've been stopped and insulted, and I know people think they're being very nice. But they say things that we can't say on radio, and they ask me if that's what I'm really like. It's kind of a difficult question to answer. On occasions, I've managed to be able to say, yes, I am like that. No, that's me. It's not the character. And sometimes that works okay, but sometimes it leads to arrests.
I know that you're interested in circuses and carnivals, and that you've done some juggling yourself.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I'm juggling right now.
Well, how did you get interested in that?
Actually, I was in a play in New York back in 1977, playing a court jester with a very beloved friend of mine, Tom Tammy. Our job was to upstage each other night after night, and somewhere along the way to about 150 performances, my friend Tom Tammy came out juggling in this one-upsmanship sort of scene, and he won the battle for the king's attention that evening. The next day, I sucked the skill out of his mind as quickly as possible and got it into my hands, and we became juggling partners, and then later I hooked up with some very talented gentlemen at the Big Apple Circus, which was just forming in New York at that time, and began, I guess, what would be a history of the circus world, circus arts being a great influence on my development as an actor.
Yeah, how have circus arts affected your acting?
Well, you know, Terry, when I was in high school and for a period in college, I could still be considered somewhat of an okay athlete. And in fact, I carried around that kind of physical life. And I found over a number of years, particularly in the mid-70s and later 70s, after I'd learned to juggle and then I learned to ride a unicycle and walk a little tightrope, that I was able to convert my athleticism into much more of a disciplined, dare I say, aesthetic value for me.
It's interesting for you to describe how athletic you couldn't help but look in a role, you know, on the New Heart Show. You seem very unathletic, like someone who wouldn't you know, jog or play tennis or basketball because it might mess their hair up.
Absolutely.
Did juggling and circus arts also help you learn how to not look athletic if you didn't need to look athletic?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, hopefully Michael is kind of proof of that. But yes, I mean, it's not that you appear, you have to suggest that you're clumsy to appear non-athletic. It's really a state of mind. And once you can kind of find the state of mind for that illusion, then the body sort of follows. In fact, they asked me a couple of years ago in a scene, they were asking me to change a shirt and take a shirt off and then put a sweater on in a scene. And I said, I can't do this. And they said, why not? I said, well, because Michael can't possibly be as well built as I am. We can't do this, you know. I found a way to do it in which we could hide it. I was halfway behind a door, and I had the sweater in my hand. As the shirt came off, the sweater was already on. I take that kind of strange concern with me to work. I sometimes am a little too picky, but I really like to try and give the audience a kind of the best representation and not lie to them.
Are you recognized when you're out of character?
Yes, I am. Consistently recognized. And what's been nice in the last year is that I don't seem to be getting recognized as the character. This was something that was happening in the last, you know, prior 2 or 3 years. But in this last year, some sort of sensibility has come into my life or from the outside world, where people know that I'm this actor who plays this character. What I do get is when people do recognize me, they often laugh. It's like I have something on my head that I'm not aware of, and I really get a kick out of it. It's not what I might have imagined, but they do. They look and they go, "Oh, that's that guy." Look at him. It's kind of funny.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Terry. Thanks for having me.
Peter Scolari plays Michael Harris on the TV show Newhart. The show airs Monday nights at 8 p.m. on CBS. Peter Scolari juggles on this week's episode. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story is your following?
Well, our top story today comes out of New York. Imelda Marcos pleaded not guilty to charges of racketeering and fraud. Her bail was set at $5 million, and it's money her lawyer says that she doesn't have, so it's not clear yet how she's going to come up with her bail. Also, a report on charges made by a former technician for Morton Thiokol. That's the company that makes booster rockets for the space shuttle. The technician says that he tried to point out safety problems at the company's Utah plant, but that he was reprimanded by his superiors. And we have, in honor of Halloween, a review of a spooky book tonight. It's The Queen of the Damned. It's by Anne Rice.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For 7 years in the late 60s and early 70s, Mission Impossible was one of the most popular series on television. Now ABC is trying to repeat that success. TV critic David Bianculli has a review of the new Mission Impossible.
This summer, when TV writers were in the middle of their 5-month strike, ABC announced that one way it would deal with the absence of new scripts was to film old ones, to take an old series or special and make a brand new version with a new cast. This idea, which might be described as an instant rerun, can't be credited solely to the writer's strike. NBC's recent revival of the Alfred Hitchcock anthology series took old scripts from that show and made them again, and for the most part improved upon the originals. So when ABC decided that it would remake episodes of Mission Impossible, it sounded like a potentially good idea. Which of the memorably far-fetched stories would ABC revive? The one where they used drugs and cosmetic surgery to convince an aging mafia leader that he's back in his salad days of prohibition? The one where they used drugs and hypnosis to convince a bad guy that he really had a nice streak and suddenly wanted to settle down and get married? Or the one where they used drugs to knock a guy out and convince him that he'd survived a plane crash but landed on an uncharted island overrun by prison escapees? In the old days, the Impossible Missions Force used drugs a lot. Not personally, but on the bad guy of the week. Anyway, all of this conjecture turns out to be a waste of time, because when the writer's strike ended, ABC decided that it had time to order new scripts after all. So it hastily dispatched writers to crank out new stories featuring an almost all-new cast of characters. One holdover from the old show is Peter Graves as Jim Phelps, who is brought out of retirement to avenge the murder of his best friend. The other holdover is a very familiar voice, heard on CD this time instead of reel-to-reel tape.
Your mission, Jim, should you decide to accept it, is to ensure Connor's conviction and thereby deliver a body blow to the entire world of organized crime. As always, should you or any of your IM force be caught or killed, the Secretary will disavow any knowledge of your actions. This disc will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
In the 60s, the IM force was a group of hidden heroes. But in the 80s, the blatant political deniability of this secret agency brings to mind too many recent scandals. Replace Peter Graves with Ollie North, and you see the problem. That doesn't really get in the way of the enjoyment of the show, though. It just makes you feel a little guilty if you do enjoy it. The updated technology in the new Mission Impossible is fun to watch, and it's a mindlessly entertaining exercise to compare the new IM Force with its series of predecessors. The most direct comparison, of course, is Phil Morris, who plays Grant Collier, a second-generation IMF member. He's the real-life son of Greg Morris, who played Barney Collier on the old series. And based on the new show's first episode, it appears that the father was much better at perspiring under pressure. The writers are under even more pressure, and they've started out by making some ridiculously stupid errors. Here's a scene in which a hitman is driven by taxi from the London airport to a nearby hotel. He's detained when a policeman stops the cab for speeding. And both the cab driver and the cop, of course, are IMF members in disguise.
You were going 20 miles over the speed limit.
20 miles? Listen, officer, this fare of mine is in a bit of a hurry. You see, I picked him up at Heathrow.
Could I just see your license, please, sir?
Would you have a heart, mate?
Now, excuse me for being picky, but wouldn't a London police officer measure speed in kilometers, not miles? It's the sort of mistake that, in the old Mission Impossible series, might have tipped off the bad guy that the whole thing was a quick and dirty setup. In the new Mission Impossible, ABC is hoping that viewers won't notice, or, in true Mission Impossible spirit, will decide to accept it.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, a return visit from jazz record producer Orrin Keepnews. Over the past 30 years, he's recorded some of the biggest names in jazz, including Thelonious Monk, McCoy Tyner, and Sonny Rollins. Keepnews' liner notes and jazz essays are collected in a new book. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles High Records, the Memphis label that recorded Al Green's classic works. And book critic John Leonard reviews new novels by the Chilean writers Isabel Allende and Ariel Dorfman. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Fred Landerow, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.